It's Wednesday, March the 24th, and you're listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution. And if my voice is familiar to you, that's because I've been doing the Area 45 podcast for the past several years for Hoover. But with the 45th presidency over and my being incapable of finding a clever 46 other than the 46 defense the Chicago Bears had about a million years ago, we came up with a new title and we call it Matters of Policy and Politics. We hope you enjoy it. By the way, we are not the only Hoover Institution podcast in town. There is Econ Talk with Russ Roberts, The Grumpy Economist with John Cochran, The Libertarian with Richard Epstein, The Pacific Century with Misha Oslin and John Yu, and finally Goodfellows, which is one of my favorites because I do that show. I'm the moderator. And we have on Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran. It's both a video and an audio broadcast that we do every week. So there's plenty to choose from. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, very simple. You just go to the Hoover Institution's website, which is hoover.org. Click on the publications tab. You'll then see a podcast tab to click on. You can subscribe to any or all of them. You can also sign up for what we call the Pod Blast, which is a monthly email we put out giving you the best of our podcast. And hopefully I'll make the cut one of these days. Hoover Institution podcast, just one part of ideas defining a free society. My guest today, joining me from across the country, normally he's in Montana, big sky country, when not in residence at the Hoover Institution. But today we find him along the shores of Florida as my colleague, Terry Anderson. Terry is the Hoover Institution's John and Jean Deneau Senior Fellow and Professor Emeritus at Montana State University. Terry Anderson is one of the founders of free market environmentalism, the idea of using markets and property rights to solve environmental problems. He is the author or editor of 39 books, including 2016's Unlocking the Wealth of Indian Nations, exploring the institutional underpinnings of American Indian reservation economies. He's joining us today to talk about President Biden's Interior Secretary and what agenda she might pursue. Terry, great to have you on the podcast. Tell me about life in Florida.
Oh, Bill, even compared to Montana, where life is quite opened up, here it's as if there was no pandemic.
So what stands out, Terry? So if I gave you the California report, I would say it's difficult to get in a restaurant, limited capacity, mask vigilance, just very quiet streets at night, people kind of going to the mall but being very worried about it. It sounds like Florida is just much more open.
Yes, I'm sitting here looking out at a row of hotels along Marco Island, thousands of units, and it is jam-packed. There are no vacancies. Car rentals are hard to get. If you go into a bar or restaurant, you have a mask on when you walk in and take it off instantly. It was just in the supermarket, and masks are required and used there. But after that, there's just hardly any evidence of the pandemic at all. And Montana's been pretty much the same as well. We have big, wide open spaces, which helps a great deal.
What you have in Montana, Terry, not to get too far off subject, you have a land rush going on, I think. I have a friend, a very good friend. She is trying to buy a property in Hamilton. And she says the problem is anytime property comes up and she's looking for land, somebody comes in and sandbags her. And it's usually some guy from California who's got money and they just come in and they throw up the market. So you're smiling, but it must be good to be sitting on land in Montana right now.
For sure. Just since we've been gone, our neighbors sold their house. They put it on the market about 5 days before we left, and we've been gone just over a week. At $1 million, it's a relatively modest house on 2 acres, something like that. It's a wonderful house. I like it, but it's not a $1 million house, I wouldn't think. And we heard since being here, it went, it sold almost instantly for over asking price.
And Terry, what happens when all those Californians bring their California sensibilities? You know what I'm
saying. Oh, my goodness, Bill. Well, Montana went Republican down the line in the election, but it's at Gallatin County, where I live, Bozeman, Montana, just north of Yellowstone, is a completely different place. It is it is very, very liberal, very, very much more like California.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting to see how that plays out if we're going to have a debate over gun control in Congress, given the shootings the past 2 weeks.
Well, the debates in the Montana legislature going on now are about relaxing concealed carry rules and about making sure that trapping and hunting are a part of the state constitution. So that still is quite different from what we have in Bozeman.
Okay, well, let's get on with the topic today, which is the Interior Department. And by the way, I'm glad to see you're in Mako Island, which means you're on the west side. So you're not one of those crazy people running amok in Miami right now.
No, hardly. I'm on the family side, even though it's just Monica and me here. By the way, back to your earlier introduction, I have to correct your number of 39 books.
Oh, you hit 40.
My 40th book, not to brag about it as much as to put in a plug for it. My 40th book will come out from the Hoover Institution next week, Adapt and Be Adept, Market Responses to Climate Change. We're excited about it. It's got some great pieces in it. It's an edited book. But when that's out and in your hand, maybe we'll do that on the podcast too.
Hey, congratulations. You're up to 40 now. Good job. We had George Will on the Goodfellas broadcast the other week, and I think he's at like 13 or 14 or 15, something like that. So you're lapping Mr. Will considerably.
What a slacker.
Exactly. Okay, Terry, let's talk about Deb Holland. She is the new Interior Secretary, the 54th individual to hold that post. What stands out about her, Terry, she was a first-term congresswoman from New Mexico before being elevated. She is the first Native American to hold a cabinet position. She is a member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe. What's interesting about her, Terry, is that I looked up her confirmation, and as soon as Biden nominated her, we immediately went into a political divide. The left just loved the choice of her because of diversity. In this woke age, having a Native American to run Interior, the left just thinks is fantastic. And the right, Terry, it couldn't come after her any harder, criticize her. They see her as an enemy of fossil fuels. Somebody will not hesitate to ban fracking on public lands. In fact, here is a quote from your Senator Steve Daines. He's a Republican from Montana. Quote, "I'm deeply concerned with the Congresswoman's support on several radical issues that will hurt Montana, our way of life, our jobs in rural America." So, Terry, when you hear Steve Daines say, "hurt Montana, our way of life, and our jobs in rural America," what's he getting at?
Well, I've watched the debate, actually, in the confirmation hearing in the Senate, and watched in particular the part with Steve. I say Steve because he was a student of mine, so I think he's well-trained. Mm-hmm. And Steve questioned her extensively about what her positions were on oil and gas development generally, certainly on public lands, of which the state is one-third public lands in Montana, so shutting down oil and gas development is a big deal. Total opposition to fracking, which was a huge boom to Montana when that revolution took place.
Right.
He questioned her over and over, and he would read the quotes, and she would simply say, "I work for the president. I will do what the president says I should do." That alone is, I think, somewhat frightening. Right. But it's pretty clear where Biden stands on all those issues. And if you diverge then from the oil and gas to other environmental issues, for example, endangered species, the grizzly bear in Montana has been downlisted. But the numbers far exceed what was considered to be necessary to have them recovered. There are now over 800, and 300 was the recovery target. They aren't delisted. They can't be managed by the state of Montana. And Holland emphatically was quoted before the hearings as saying, "I will not allow delisting of any species." Steve Daines took her to task on that. And again, it was simply, "I will do what the president tells me to do." So she is a puppet for the president, and it will mean significant. It will have significant implications for the public land states like Montana and much of the other Western states.
Okay, you want to play a little Interior Department Jeopardy with me, Terry? I'm going to ask you the Democratic president. Let's see if you can get the Interior Secretary. Shall we play along?
Yeah, but you're probably going to get me on this one.
Okay, Jimmy Carter, who was his Interior Secretary? No,
Pardon?
No. Cecil Andrus.
Andrus. Okay. All right. I was getting close.
Probably known best for the Alaska Lands Act.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton's pick for Interior was, he held the job all 8 years from Arizona.
Really, really nasty to me here, Bill. Clinton.
Former governor of Arizona. Babbitt. Bruce Babbitt.
Babbitt.
Right.
Monica's in the background helping me, so.
All right. Babbitt, do you remember Wampum Gate? That happened under his watch. Wampum Gate, Terry, was a situation where apparently a Wisconsin casino had been, an Indian casino in Wisconsin, been denied a license and apparently got caught up in a matter of political donations and not the question whether or not Babbitt was on the wrong side of that. So I just love the name Wampum Gate. And then finally, Terry, Obama's Interior Secretary is Ken Salazar. And Salazar is interesting because he was close to coal and mining. As a Colorado senator, but now you have Deb Haaland, who is a departure. And is this really as radical a departure as it would seem for an Interior Secretary?
Well, I want to back up just a little bit and say that Bush too had a secretary who was a good friend of mine. She and I met with Bush beforehand and ran the kind of line that I would run regarding many of these issues. And now I'm drawing a blank on Gail Norton,
right.
And so, you know, if you compare someone like Gail with someone like now Secretary Haaland, they illustrate the stark contrast between really all of the secretaries you've mentioned and the Republican administrations. That said, Haaland is yet a stark contrast to the ones you've named. There's never been such an ardent stance against oil and gas development as this administration has taken, and as Deb Haaland took long before it was an administration. She was one of the founders of the Green New Deal, and that makes, you know, that's where a lot of this started, and she intends to keep that ball rolling.
Right. And if the Biden administration is serious about Green New Deal and about getting away from fossil fuels, she has to walk the walk on this, doesn't she? She has to ban fracking.
Oh, absolutely. I just listened to a podcast today, actually one that I will record next week on my book, Adapt and Be Adept. Fracking is still going on, and it's still a large part of the answer to the energy solutions, even as it relates to climate change. But under Haaland, there will be no fracking if she has anything to do with it.
Okay, we have her to the left on fracking. We have her to the left on species. What else do you see her going to the left on as an Interior Secretary?
Well, those cover a lot of it. She'll go to the left if you can go farther to the left than, say, the Obama administration did on establishing national monuments, even national parks. I think you'll see her really more strict in the national parks and monuments as to what can go on. Of course, again, no oil and gas development in the parks, but I think you'll see many more regulations of what people can do. I often quip that if you go to Yellowstone and have fun, you must be breaking a rule. And I suspect she's going to have even more restrictions on what goes on in parks.
So, Terry, what could she reverse that the Trump administration did?
Well, she won't reverse, of course, the establishment or disestablishment, I should say, of the national monuments. That's not in her power. It's the executive that can. But she will certainly encourage the president to reverse many of these monument decisions that Obama went wild on and Trump tried to roll back on. So I think that'll be one of the areas she'll be the most effective in making changes.
And that's all stroke of a pen actions, executive orders.
Oh, certainly. I mean, it's a stroke of a pen action by the president and then stroke of a pen action by her when she tells her people get to work enforcing these. Already, Bears Ears, which was one of the big controversial monuments created by Obama, a huge monument, reversed, not totally reversed, but downsized significantly by Trump, and now to be resized upwards by Biden. And to the point of her heritage, many tribes in the Utah, New Mexico, Arizona area have argued that that should not have been downsized as Trump did. So she will be following the president, but also following her tribal compatriots.
Right. Let's talk about the tribal compatriots. You've written an article for Hoover's Defining Ideas, a piece on what she could do for Native Americans. It's really a wonderful read. And I encourage our listeners to check it out when it comes online. Every time I read your stuff, Terry, I learn something new. And what I learned new from this was that there are actually 56 million acres of land when we talk about Native Americans. That's about half the size of California. That is a huge chunk of turf.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Let me back up one more point about that. Wanted to make on the what else she might do. Of course, the Outer Continental Shelf all comes under the umbrella of the Department of Interior, and the OCS lands have been incredibly important for oil and gas development sitting here on the Gulf Coast. Of course, you see that especially. But to your question, yeah, 56 million acres is a staggering amount of land, and when you look. First, just at Interior generally, you've got national parks, which is probably where people first think of the Department of Interior. But then quickly you go to the Bureau of Land Management, huge land management agency, the biggest of all. And then, of course, the Interior Department's stranglehold on tribes. Most tribal lands, most reservation lands, are, as one of my Native American friends puts it, owned by the federal government. And so she has charge over that huge estate.
Mm-hmm. Before we get deeper into your article, Terry, can you quickly explain to me how a tribe gets sovereign status, how a tribe actually gets land?
Well, most of the tribes, especially the large tribes in the West, got their land got their land after we took it away from them. Right. Got their land via treaties. And of course, the Indian Wars following the Civil War is how most of them were pushed onto reservation.
Right.
I did a wonderful study with a good friend who's passed away, Fred McChesney, looking at just how the Indian Wars evolved following the Civil War. And what's interesting is You can date the Indian Wars to the end of the Civil War because it's when we had a standing army. And it was people like Custer who were bored with their positions out in the Wild West where it was dusty, hot, and not much to do. And they were elevated to brevet rank as in the Civil War. So General Custer, who was lieutenant colonel, liked fighting Indians. They probably didn't like it the last time he fought them, but so the point here is just that's how the U.S. got control of those lands. Then they were given back by treaties and then whittled away. Some of the work I've done has followed reservations such as the Crow Reservation, which was a huge reservation. Mm-hmm. And as gold was developed, discovered on the north edge of Yellowstone Park, we took away that section of the Crow Reservation. When the Northern Pacific Railroad came through and wanted coal, we took away the coal reserves, not all of them that the Crow had, but a significant amount. So eventually they were whittled back to where they are today. Today, however, if you were a tribe that lost all your lands and didn't get any by treaty, mm-hmm. and if you were a tribe that was taken off tribal status in the 1950s when the federal government was trying to assimilate tribes into the U.S. Economy and into the citizens, into the regular citizenship, as you and I would think. But those tribes had no land. And a good friend who was at that time the chief of the Coushatta tribe in Louisiana went out and he petitioned Interior to be re-recognized. He wanted their tribe to be re-recognized so they could resurrect the tribal culture, language, basket weaving, arts. And they said, well, we can't re-recognize you because you don't have any land. And so Ernest Zicke went out and bought 15 acres of land, then said, well, now can you recognize us? And the Bureau of Indian Affairs said, now we recognize you. And Ernest says, and then we were Indians. So some tribes have actually bought land.
I've always been curious about this, Terry, because when you come to Stanford, you're a neighbor of mine here at the Stanford West complex where I live. And there's a beautiful green belt looking out from the apartments here. And I've always understood that this green belt stays this way for two reasons. Number one, it's just an environmental balance to building on this big strip of grass. But secondly, there were some Indian overtures. The Ohlone tribe used to walk this land. If you go over to the Stanford campus, Terry, there's a little memorial over to the Ohlones. It's getting literally devoured by development all over the place, but there's at least some recognition of Native American heritage. I've always been curious, Terry, why the Ohlones don't band together, find a whole bunch of Ohlones, go to the government and ask for a little bit of Stanford's considerable amount of land, take that land, put a casino on it, and there you are next door to a bunch of wealthy kids at Stanford. And if I understand it correctly, I think you can drink at age 18 in an Indian casino. So I think, Terry, that would make a considerable amount of money.
Yes, Mike, I don't know anything about the number of who are left from that tribe and how much political clout they would have. But some tribes have done just that. And of course, in order to have a casino, the casino must be on land held in trust by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So back to Coushatta, when they bought their land, they bought it with the purpose of then engaging in a compact, which is a necessary part of gaming, with the state. So Louisiana and the Coushatta case, California would be the state entity with which any tribe would have to deal to get permission. Permission is not a correct word. Would have to negotiate to enable it to build a casino. The Coushatta did that on their trust land. And they used the money from that to now they own 7,000 acres of private land, fee simple land, not held in trust. So they don't trust the federal government to hold their land in trust.
I worked for a California governor in a past life. I can tell you that when it comes to negotiation with tribes in California, it's very complicated. There's a lot of money involved. The tribes spend a lot of money on consulting. They'll spend a lot of money going to the ballot to get measures done as well. Actually, when Jerry Brown was mayor of Oakland, there was talk about doing a casino in downtown Oakland, which didn't go very far. I don't think the locals like the idea of it, but it's always been a temptation in California. It's just kind of a shortcut to money and, frankly, a way to just appeal to Indians, just let them build a casino. And I'm not sure if that's always the best thing for the tribe.
Well, it isn't always the best thing for the tribe, but it's often the only source of revenue that a tribe can really have. Take the Coushatta as an example of that, for sure. Although now they, with their 7,000 acres, they have soybean farms, crawfish farms, they own oil, and they are the third largest private employer in the state of Louisiana. So they're obviously doing more than just their casino. Other tribes, the Ute tribe, to get us back to oil and gas development, have a great deal of oil and gas potential on their lands, and they have successfully tapped those reserves and made a lot of money from them. They even have purchased wells far away from them out in the Gulf of Mexico. So they own potential oil development all over the country, really.
And you mentioned this. And you mentioned this in your article. How did the Utes do this, Terry? Did it just dawn upon them to do this, or did outside forces come to them and say, "You're sitting on this oil"? How did they work the process?
Well, there has been some hope for Native Americans through a law passed. I can't even remember the date now. That allows probably at least 20 years ago, maybe more. That allows tribes to contract with the Bureau of Indian Affairs to take control of managing certain aspects of their resources. So in the case of the Ute, it's oil and gas. In the case of the Salish Kootenai Confederated Tribes on the Flathead Reservation in Montana, it's timber resources. In the case of the Crow, and they wish it had been their coal reserves, they are the largest coal owner in the United States. They did not do that. So, and then the war on coal did them in. I might note that when President Obama declared his war on coal, much like Deb Haaland's war on oil and gas, the chairman of the Crow tribe at the time, Darren Old Coyote, said, "Your war on coal is a war on my people." He might have added again. But there are some ways in which tribes can gain control of things like oil. They're almost all natural resources, oil and gas, timber, fisheries. And when they do, they typically do a better job.
Okay, let's get into your article now, because you're talking not just about oil and gas, you're talking about a change in mindset on the part of the federal government. Let me read you a passage of what you wrote, Terry. Quote, as Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland needs to strip the explicit racism from federal Indian policy. Nothing is more racist than calling people wards and giving the government the authority to declare them competent and capable. That's strong words, racism.
Well, the strong word comes from the stronger words, in my opinion, capable and competent and ward. Those are all words in legislation and in court rulings. So let me start with those and then build to racism. John Marshall, who's a hero of mine as a Supreme Court justice, in a ruling in 1832, declared the relationship of Indians to the federal government as that of a ward to his guardian. Just think about those words for a moment and imagine that you live in a country where the federal government is the guardian for some group of people that we declare to be wards in the way we might we do with young people, if you will, and their parents, the way we do with people who have less mental capacity. It's the only group in the United States that is a ward of the federal government. So that's amazing. And then following that, in legislation passed in the late 1800s and early 1900s, the words capable and competent were included in legislation. And those laws said that the federal government shall hold the land in trust until it declares the owners, the Indians, competent and capable. Once again, those are words that are as racist as anything I can imagine. It's saying your race is not competent and capable until we, the government of the United States, declares you to be. That is racism pure and simple, and it's racism that ought to be eliminated. And it's something Deb Haaland should work on.
But Terry, it's a 19th century mentality. It's the same as saying African-Americans are only 3/5 of a vote or women should not be able to vote. And we've changed these things over the years. So here we are in the 21st century, but federal policy still treats Indians fundamentally as lesser beings. So why has this not been changed?
Well, partly it's because it's a relatively small portion of the population. Less than 5% of the U.S. population is Native American. And I think that makes it different. The other part is that over time, the bureaucracy that has been built up at the Bureau of Indian Affairs is a bureaucracy that hands out money, hands out grants. And I want to disabuse anybody of the image that the Native Americans just stand in line at the Bureau of Indian Affairs office waiting for their weekly or monthly check.
Right.
It's not that way. They don't get that much money in terms of handouts that come on that basis. But the tribes get grants, and the people in the tribes who work on getting those grants like their jobs. They like being the ones who are the funnel for the money that comes in. You talked about the kind of money involved in casinos. That's what's involved with many of these government programs. And so we've built a bureaucracy around this ward-guardian relationship. The guardians like it, and many of the wards like it.
Right. So in your column, you suggest that we need a dependency from federal government, in this case, public services, Terry. You mentioned education, police protection, low-income housing, food subsidies, infrastructure. But how would you make that transition?
Well, again, I just want to emphasize, being here in Florida, I spoke to a group of federal judges last week, and I started my presentation saying, imagine a country where some people are considered to be wards, where there's a single payer healthcare system, and I listed all the things you just described.
Right.
And when you teed up with the title of having Native Americans in it, so they knew the answer. But all of these things are provided by the federal government. And I want to emphasize provided, not just paid for, but provided by. So the federal government has the Indian Healthcare Service. The federal government has the schools and controls the schools and so on. So what the first step would, the best step would be to give tribes more authority for even taxation, but certainly management of the resources as we've described the Ute, and let them use that money as they see fit. The Ute have very good schools, they have very good health service, they have very good roads, the infrastructure, all the things that we typically think of government. But short of that, simply saying to the tribes, you run your schools, they're your schools, you figure out what you want. Let them contract out for health services so that they can seek the lowest cost, best provider. Much could be done to give tribes more authority, but that means stop treating them as wards. Let them make their own decisions.
Right. This sounds sort of like the welfare debate of the 1990s, just
totally
getting people off of dependents. This is a Hoover Institution podcast, and so we always need to reflect on Herbert Hoover. And so let's talk now about Charles Curtis. Why don't you explain to us who Charles Curtis was and his relevance to Native Americans?
Well, one day while touring some of the Hoover archives, I came across the fact that President Hoover's vice president was none other than Charles Curtis, 1/8 Kaw Indian. I was just flabbergasted. Here's a person of color elected nearly 100 years ago.
This was a bragging point for Kamala Harris in 2020. Would that have been a bragging point for Charles Curtis in 1928, or had he even just covered that up?
I don't know whether I think it would have been a. I think it probably was to a certain extent a bragging point for him. He was touted as being an Indian horse rider of tremendous excellence, and he played off of that all the time. So I don't know that he emphasized certainly not the person of color, since that wasn't the accepted term at that time. Right. But when he finally had an office in the White House, he had an Indian jazz band. He decorated his office with lots of tribal artifacts. He had a chief's chair that he sat in. So he certainly played off of that. When I first saw this, given that we have a project at Hoover on renewing indigenous economies, I thought, wow, here's a hero that we can hold up, except that his past regarding the issues we've been talking about is somewhat checkered. He supported boarding schools for Indians, a place where their young people were plucked from their parents' hands and sent off to be civilized. He was very much in favor of dismantling tribes and integrating Native Americans into American society and so on. So I wasn't quite sure he was the hero I wanted to have for a Hoover project, given that I don't think that he was following the path that really is a path that comes from defining ideas of a free society.
Right, but he was a senator. He had been giving thought to the Indian quandary, if you want to call it that, a quandary.
Yeah, for sure. And but it said, one quote I found said he was 1/8 Kaw Indians and 7/8 incompetent. So he wasn't necessarily seen as the best vice president ever.
You know, the 1920s were a fascinating period. I'll be curious if the 2020s is the same, because you have just a great economic boom. You have some interesting political characters come along at the same time, like Curtis and, of course, Warren Harding and the General Harding administration, which certainly was pretty adventurous for 3 years.
Absolutely. I hadn't thought about the notion of the 20s and the 20s, but it might be a good comparison to see what the kind of prosperity we've had means for moving forward on these kinds of issues.
People talk about it because they think that we're going to have basically a giddy champagne high with the economy once society loosens up and people can live their lives fully. And then it begs the question of Joe Biden being this decade's Cal Coolidge, if you will, which Maybe Joe Biden is kind of reserved in terms of his public image, as Coolidge was. You know, Biden is only giving a press conference tomorrow for the first time in his presidency. He's yet to address Congress. So like Coolidge, he's kind of a man of few words. On the other hand, if you look at the Coolidge agenda versus the Biden agenda, I don't think the two necessarily square up, Terry, which does get us back to Deb Haaland. So what are you looking for when it comes to Deb Haaland and in Native American relations? What do you think she might do? What are you hoping she might do?
Well, let me begin by emphasizing she didn't create the ward guardian relationship. She can't simply take away laws that call them that say they have to be deemed competent and capable. That said, she is the trustee for millions of acres of Indian lands, and she can reduce the amount of federal oversight over those lands and let the tribes have more control. She can say, and this is something that could be done literally with a stroke of a pen through the BIA, she could say, we want to back off of telling tribes whether they will or will not develop their coal. Let the Ute tribe or the other tribes with oil and gas, let those tribes decide if they want to manage their oil and gas. And that's something easily in her bag of tools. She I think could go a long ways toward giving tribes more control over issues such as national monument management. Mm-hmm. Many of these monuments are considered to be sacred tribal ground. Well, why, if they're sacred tribal ground, do they have to be managed by a federal agency thousands of miles away? Canyon de Chelly is managed by the Navajo. Let tribes that are considered to hold these as sacred grounds have control of those lands. I would even say give them to them, but then they still would be in trust. So I think there are these kinds of simple things that she can do. And then I think she could just simply raise the what we talked about a few minutes ago, raise the notion of racism as it applies to American Indians, and let the American people know that this is the only group, the only minority in this country that we say is not competent and capable. And I think that would be a step towards saying, these are competent and capable people, and they are the people who should have control of their lives.
I noticed, by the way, Terry, that the Biden administration withdrew their choice for undersecretary.
Oh, I hadn't seen that.
Yeah, they pulled her back the other day, and I guess it was just too much even for Democrats. This choice was just too anti-oil and gas, so I guess maybe there are limits with Congress as to how far you can go.
Well, it's important to note that Haaland was confirmed 51-40, and it was only, surprisingly, I would say, with people like Murkowski from Alaska, where it's going to have huge impacts on the state of Alaska, as well as huge effects on the.
My next question. What is Lisa Murkowski thinking?
I have no idea. And then the Brasser from Wyoming, the same. He went out in total defense of her when Senator Daines was simply questioning her on these stands. And those are two states, Wyoming and Alaska, are going to really take a hit given that her administration and the Biden administration have asserted no oil and gas leasing on federal lands. Maybe the one part that I would say to explain it is, and this is important, she is the first Native American Interior Secretary. And given that she is, she deserves a chance to do what we've been talking about here, to resurrect the dignity that Native Americans had and deserve to get back.
Yeah, I think you just may have tapped into the key here, Terry, in that she is historic in the choice of her. And a Republican, you're making this calculation. I could try to block her nomination, but this will end up being a 50-50 vote, and Kamala Harris will come in and break it. And so I will be on the wrong side of history, if you will. But it does bet. I am curious as to why Murkowski did this, because she is up for re-election in 2022. It's already going to be a difficult re-election. You know, Donald Trump has promised to come into Alaska and primary her because of her vote on impeachment. impeachment. He's not going to run for the Senate, but he'll find some you know, MAGA character to run on his behalf. So to vote this way on what ultimately is a serious pocketbook issue for Alaska, just it's a curious choice.
Yeah, well, Steve Daines was just reelected and reelected by a huge margin in Montana.
Yes.
But when you move to the bluer parts of Montana where there are those pockets, this will come up the next time he's up for reelection. And it'll be something that I think Democratic candidates from the state house all the way up through Senate seats are going to raise every time, saying he disliked Native Americans, when in fact his questioning and his stance had nothing to do with her being Native American, had everything to do with her being a deeper shade of green than virtually anybody else.
So she had the potential to be this decade's James Watt.
Well,
she's not going to ban the Beach Boys from the mall, but Watt very quickly became a lightning rod.
Yeah, well, no, I don't think she'll be a lightning rod as Jim Watt was. You know, Jim Watt was noted for supposedly wanting to privatize the federal estate. And after he left office, I was at a conference with him, and I raised the question of why do you think fewer lands weren't privatized during the Reagan administration and your term at Interior? And Jim looked at me and said, because I didn't want them privatized. So it was an image he had. It made him a lightning rod. But I don't think Deb Haaland will be a lightning rod, in part because of what we were just mentioning. She is a Native American. And I think the average American, even Republican right-wing Americans, do want to respect Native Americans and give them the dignity that they once had.
Exactly. I love the Chief Joseph quote that you have in your article.
You know, Chief Joseph is a real hero and of mine. Of course, Chief Joseph was relegated to a reservation that had nothing to do with his ancestral lands. Mm-hmm. Reservation in Idaho, he finally said, enough's enough. He left the reservation with a group of his people. They made it to Montana. They were attacked by the cavalry and decimated. He and a few managed to get away before being captured just short of the Canadian border. My wife and I were up there recently and saw the place where he was captured, and it almost brings tears to your eyes. He would have had freedom if he had made it to Canada. And the freedom he asked for was, let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to choose where I wish to trade, free to follow the religion of my fathers, mm-hmm. Free to think,
choose my own teacher,
and act for myself. I may have left one of the frees out of there, but you know, you read that what he asked for and say, wait, you mean there is a group of Americans who don't have that freedom? And the answer is yes. American Indians don't have the freedoms that Chief Joseph called for in 1879, and Deb Haaland is a person who could help them achieve those kinds of freedoms.
Here's the exact quote, quote, let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to trade where I choose, free to choose my own teacher, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself.
Yeah, I missed the free to follow the religion of my fathers. There again, you know, this whole effort at civilization was, they stopped the Sundance, they stopped potlatching in the Pacific Northwest, all ceremonies that Native Americans have in the interest of, in most cases, Christianizing them. You know, free to choose my own teachers. No, we're going to have schools that choose teachers for you. So those are basic freedoms that every American should have. They, you know, his statement reads like the Declaration of Independence, and yet still to this day, more than 200 years later, the Native Americans don't have that.
I'll let you go in a couple minutes, Terry. I want you to have dinner with your lovely bride and walk the beach and enjoy the sunset on the Gulf Coast of Florida, which I used to do with my dear old dad. He loved to go to a Siesta Key and Anna Maria Island. Those were his go-to places. Florida tourism ad there. Let's talk a bit about your book before we leave, Climate Change. I was watching our colleague John Cochran last week testify before a Senate committee, and the topic was climate change and economic disruption on climate change, and I could not have turned into a more depressing hearing. It's not a reflection on John. John's brilliant. What was depressing was this, Terry. You had Republican senators and Democratic senators, liberal economists, conservative economists. So Elizabeth Warren asks a question to the liberal economist who just confirms what Elizabeth Warren thinks. Republican senators did the same with conservative economists. I didn't see any senators challenging the other side in terms of thinking. It seems both sides are just kind of set on climate change. So as you sat down to write a book on climate change, what do you hope to add to this conversation?
I hope and I think this book adds to the conversation by providing an alternative to the regulation that so many, as you said, Republicans have bought into, an alternative that builds on market forces already at work to adapt to climate change. So this book begins with some discussion of just the inevitability of depending on carbon-based economy for the years and years to come. We simply are not in a position where where wind and solar are going to provide us with enough energy to run a country as prosperous and productive as ours. Then if we think about the regulatory schemes that are proposed, Nobel laureate Ronald Coase referred to the kinds of proposals that come forward as blackboard economics. And blackboard economics is about points to the fact that it's easy to say, let's impose a carbon tax. And our late colleague, Secretary Schultz, and I used to argue about this all the time. I can draw on a blackboard what the graphs would look like to talk about what the carbon tax would be. But this is politics, folks. And Secretary Schultz understood that well. But this is not about some optimality we're trying to achieve, but this is about command and control, and the kind of politics that we'll enter in will be no different than all other politics. It will be partisan. I always have loved when in a debate about finding cap and trade solutions for carbon emissions, and I asked Jeff Immelt why he thought was so in favor of that, and his response was, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And he was at the table. So he was going to get lots of the cap so he could trade carbon emission credits. So this is all about politics, and it will be about politics, and it won't be very effective. But you can't deny that climate change is occurring. And that then brings me to the main theme and contribution to the book, which is, as a result of climate change, asset values are changing, risks are changing. And all of those are exactly what markets deal with well. Prices on the beachfront of Miami are reflecting the fact that there is more storm surge. And whether it's caused by humans or not doesn't matter. It's happening, and people are saying, I want to move to higher ground. Some lands in the northern part of the United States are becoming much more productive for fruit production. Those land prices are going up for fruit production. And finally, if you look at how insurance and finance markets are working, they take account of risk and manage it better than any government agency could. So, and this book then documents the kind of finance responses, the kind of asset responses, the kind of insurance responses that are out there already. And that will be what has always been the solution to these kinds of problems. It will be human ingenuity.
You can appreciate this, Terry. This ties into your planning to come to the Hoover Institution, because you can come most any time you want, but you don't want to come here in the summer when we have that 1 to 2 week period where we're pretty much guaranteed blackouts.
Exactly. When in Montana, we have air conditioning that's very dependable at that time. We open a window.
Yeah, well, here in California, it's an amazing thing, Terry, because you get warned there might be a blackout. It gets hot. You're told not to use your air conditioning. And so you sit there and you swelter. You're told to keep your power off and all that. And if you lose your power, boy, you got problems. Now this ties into buying habits of food and just where you're going to go. And are you ready for a blackout? And, you know, the thing about California is we're never ready for this kind of stuff. Everybody's supposed to have an earthquake preparation, gear in their garage, water and batteries and, things like that.
You can speak to the Texans about how well the global warming, the global warming policies have worked. The subsidies to wind and solar have been huge, but this was not a market-driven response that even thought about the kind of risks that came with the great freeze in Texas. Now, mind you, that freeze affected oil and gas too, but markets will take that into account the next time.
Were you surprised by what happened in Texas?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I was delighted when I heard that it was wind turbines freezing up, and not quite so delighted when I heard it was also pumping stations for natural gas. But surprised in the sense, especially on the natural gas side, that people weren't more aware of that potential risk. But look, we live in a risky world, and you can't eliminate all risk. And we're not going to eliminate all the risks from climate change, but we can find better ways to treat the risk, to deal with the risks. And that's what insurance markets are about. And the fact that insurance markets didn't take into account what was going to happen with windmills and wind turbines in Texas is exactly why many companies went bankrupt. They didn't account for that risk enough. That won't be the case in the future.
Okay, when does book number 40 come out?
I think April 6th is the date, so around the corner. We're just awaiting copies to show up. Well, I don't know where they show up these days since everything's closed down.
You'd have to come over to the campus. You'd probably have to call somebody at administration at Hoover and drive over an appointed hour and have three passports and proof of why you're on the campus. And
I'm having mine mailed to Montana. I just hope they aren't contaminated in that transfer process.
So that's the answer. You're at the mercy of the mail system. I'm talking to you on a new laptop, which the institution gave me. Ordinarily, I bicycle over to the campus and pick it up and bicycle back. I had to drive over and do like a double secret knock on the door to have them give it to me. And even then, that didn't work. They ended up mailing it to me, actually, because just the mail is the safest way. They don't want you on the campus.
I have a printer obtained exactly that way.
Sounds good. Hey, Terry, enjoyed the conversation. How much longer are you going to be in Florida?
Well, only a couple more days, then back to Montana to endure the mud season and await an invitation to return to Hoover and meet my good friends like you.
Good. Well, it's an open invitation. We love having you on campus, and I hope we all do get there soon on campus.
All right. Well, stay free and stay well.
Thank you, Terry. You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. And if you wouldn't mind, spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's spelled @Hoover INST. I mentioned our website at the beginning of the broadcast. That's www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Terry Anderson and his Hoover colleagues. How do you do that, you might ask? Here we go again. Go to the Publications tab, go to where it says Hoover Publications, and click on Daily Report. You also see, by the way, the tab for defining ideas. You can sign up for that as well. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Matters of Policy and Politics. Till then, take care. As always, thank you for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.